You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
What's good about my father and what's unique about my father is you don't know what he's going to do.
Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country, wouldn't you think of it?
This prize reminds the world that democracy is essential to peace.
We welcome President Trump's statement. We are full steam ahead.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Nick Ludlam, SBS World News' international editor, sitting in once again for Claudia Farhart, who, after reporting from flood-affected regions in Sumatra, is now in Thailand near the border with Cambodia and will be talking to us from there shortly. I'm joined this week by SBS World News' chief political correspondent and pod regular, Anna Henderson. Hi, Anna. Really great to have you back on the pod and to be with you in Parliament House in Canberra.
Isn't this special to have us both here? Thanks, Nick. Yes, looking forward to catching up with Claudia. She has been so busy with some really incredible reporting and speaking with Bob Bowker as well about how things are going in Syria a year after the fall of Bashar al-Assad.
That's right, and we'll be chewing over the latest in the long negotiating road to peace in Ukraine. Spoiler alert, no shortcuts have yet been found. But first to Thailand and Cambodia, where cross-border clashes have erupted once again this week. International correspondent Claudia Farhart, as mentioned, joins us now from Sakhau province in Thailand. Hi, Claudia.
Hey, Nick. Hey, Anna. How are you guys doing?
We're so good, Claudia. Good to see you. Good to hear from you. Very excited to see your reporting from this part of the world.
Thanks, Hendo.
Claudia, I thought Trump had sorted out this conflict, so why are they back at it?
Yeah, it was meant to be over, right? Just like all the other peace deals. Look, no one really had that much faith in it, to be honest, when this deal was signed. Not so much in July, but more so in late October when he gathered them in Kuala Lumpur for that quite elaborate public signing ceremony. The reason being it really didn't address any of the underlying issues that brought this conflict out in the first place, right? The century of contested territory, of contested temples. And they were more or less pressured into signing it. Donald Trump made his attendance at ASEAN dependent on the fact that they would agree to sign it. He threatened to suspend their trade deals, their tariff negotiations if they didn't. Also, he could really, you know, rack up another win in the peace deal column. And pretty much since day one of this deal, both sides have been accusing the other of violating it. There's been a steady stream of smaller incidents we've seen before this week. Thailand pulled out of it altogether last month after a soldier was wounded in a landmine explosion. It said that was a freshly laid landmine. Cambodia denied that, but Thailand says that was the final straw. But it really all exploded again on Monday morning. We still don't know exactly how it started because both sides are accusing the other of firing first. But it's basically culminated in Thailand carrying out airstrikes on several positions inside Cambodia. It says it's targeting military sites, but Cambodia says that civilians are being hit, homes are being hit as well. Cambodia's firing rockets and other kinds of heavy artillery back across the border. And we really don't know how it's going to end. Thailand is talking pretty tough. It says it's going to continue these strikes until they degrade Cambodia's military capability for a long time to come. And the Thai Prime Minister is saying this time around, there's not going to be any talks.
And as you spoke there, Claudia, about just what's happening at the border, there is this serious human cost of this border war with hundreds of thousands being evacuated from both sides. So what is the situation for them now?
Yeah, we're now up to more than half a million people evacuated. Most of them are here in Thailand. They've evacuated 400,000 people in all of the provinces, pretty much all of the provinces along the border, because we now have reports that the fighting has spread right across that stretch of border. The situation for them is they are basically sheltering in these evacuation centres, in temples, in all of these makeshift spaces that have really just been urgently set up over the past day or two. Even though we were here back in July at that 5 days of fighting, this kind of erupted again with pretty much no notice. So it's been a pretty huge effort to get everyone out. As of, you know, today, we're a few days in now, but it's really taken up until this point to move that many people. And for them, we've just been spending the morning in one of these evacuation centres. What it looks like is basically hundreds of people just sleeping on the floor. There's no mattresses or bedding or anything like that. There's a big community spirit here in the border region, so the local community has come out to cook for them. They're providing supplies and things like that. But the people who were evacuated first, in many cases, were the elderly. and were the young. So we've seen a four-month-old baby and we've seen an 89-year-old man in evacuation. For the elderly, it's incredibly difficult. There's not a lot of facilities. Getting to the bathroom is difficult, they're telling us. For the babies equally, while they're, you know, cooking meals for the bulk of these evacuees, I mean, there's not baby formula, there's not nappies and things like that ready available. That stuff is going to take time to get in. So these are the sort of practical issues people are dealing with. A lot of the people we spoke to today said they've lived on this border, they've lived in their villages all their lives. And yes, it's always, you know, there's always been that underlying tension. There's always been the dispute over the territory, but they say they've never actually witnessed violence like they saw since the start of this week. They've never heard explosions. They've never heard artillery fire. They've never heard gunfire like they heard at the start of this week. A lot of people here have the mindset that they'll just tough it out. They don't need to evacuate. They want to stay and protect the village. But for a lot of them, they said this is the first time they thought, no, this is really serious. We've got to get out of there.
You make the point that this has been going on a very long time, this sort of border dispute. Does anyone think this could escalate into all-out war between these two countries?
Look, the danger is certainly there. I mean, Thailand's airstrikes are continuing. Cambodia's artillery fire is continuing. But there's also plenty of reasons to think it's not going to escalate into all-out war. The Thai foreign minister kind of gave the game away when he said that he doesn't want to see the US use the threat of tariffs to coerce either side into negotiations this time around. That's exactly how Trump forced them to the table last time. It was just ahead of his Liberation Day tariff negotiation deadline. And basically both countries were faced with threats of like 36, 38, 40% tariffs. And he said, well, if you don't sign a deal to end this, you're not getting a tariff deal. And these are manufacturing hubs. The number one way both countries make their money is selling what they make here overseas. So they couldn't cop that rate. They had to come to the table and make that deal. So yeah, if Donald Trump uses that threat again, and we've already heard him say he's going to be making phone calls to both countries and he is going to force them to stop, so it sounds like he will be making that threat again, then it doesn't seem likely that they're actually going to be able to continue, just for purely for the sake of their economies. If there is a ceasefire, though, it's probably just going to be as fragile as the last one, right? Because it's not going to address any of those underlying issues that we spoke about. It'll probably just be a matter of time until we end up here once again. But another really interesting thing to watch, and this may end up being part of the reason why we got here, there is speculation in Thailand that the Prime Minister, Anutin Chanvirakul, is getting ready to dissolve the parliament. So once he does that, that means elections have to be called within 45 to 60 days. So we know that this border crisis brought down the last prime minister, the daughter of Thaksin Shinawat. Her handling of it stirred a lot of anger in Thailand. It ended with the court dismissing her and with Anutin Chanvirakul stepping in on the condition that he'd call elections within 6 months. If he does do as a lot of people are speculating and make that move to dissolve the parliament this week, it's going to make the timing of his ordering airstrikes on Cambodia look really interesting, because we know that his party is trying to cater to its royalist base, to its nationalist base, its pro-military base. And a lot of that sector of Thai society didn't want a ceasefire in the first place. They know that Thailand has the superior army. They know if they take on Cambodia, they feel like they can win that war. So if the election is called, it might just end up being a way to sort of play to that base ahead of the vote.
Well, Claudia, we are so fortunate to have you to step us through the complexity of what's going on, to hear your view of what you've seen during your reporting, and to help us unpick these events. Stay safe. We want an update soon. Thank you. Talking of failing diplomacy, the US President Donald Trump has been generating more verbal tornadoes this week, calling European leaders weak and saying their countries were decaying.
It's really got the Europeans scrambling again. They're trying to reassure themselves and the rest of the world that they are in fact strong. But you have to wonder how they're going to fill the void Trump is threatening to create in the support for Ukraine. Trump also published his Doctrine on Foreign Policy 2 on the weekend, which also took some major swipes at Europe, saying it was heading for, quote, civilizational destruction, and that they wouldn't be able to rely on US support forever, which the Europeans have had to grudgingly agree with. It's just they aren't able to act collectively fast enough to keep up with the US. And this intervention from the Pope.
The remarks that are made about Europe, also in interviews recently, I think are trying to break apart what I think needs to be a very important alliance today and in the future. So it's a program that President Trump and his advisors put together. He's the President of the United States, has a right to do that. But it has a number of things in it that I think, perhaps many people in the United States would be in agreement, I think many others would see things in a different way.
Anna, you have your finger on the Australian political pulse. Is a similar thing being felt here?
There is a discussion happening in Australia, Nick, and it's really being driven by One Nation, which is sort of being seen now as a bit of a fourth force in Australian politics, but it's also something which the National Party and the Liberal Party are picking up on. And it centres on this discussion around mass migration, which some members of the opposition are quite keen to highlight, to repeat that language. And then there are others who are quite worried about the use of that kind of terminology and that phrase mass migration. When I spoke to the opposition leader, Susan Lee, though, just a few weeks ago about their upcoming migration policy, I challenged her on that mass migration rhetoric that we're hearing come out of the US. She wasn't prepared to shoot it down. She's not prepared to say that mass migration isn't an issue in Australia, even though the facts demonstrably show that in Australia there has been an increase in migration, but nowhere near the kind of levels that are being discussed in the US and the UK. So it's something which is becoming part of the fabric of the national conversation. And there's an international movement between Reform UK, between the Trump administration, and this national security strategy has highlighted that again. And it's interesting to note that the US State Department has instructed its embassy in Australia to collect data on migrant crime here. And when the defense minister and the foreign minister were in Washington, D.C. this week, having private talks with Pete Hegseth and Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, it has not become clear, and the Australian side has been reticent to reveal whether behind the scenes that issue of migration was raised on the US side or the Australian side.
So this is actually this whole sort of MAGA movement joining hands around the world with other like-minded, let's say, political affiliations driving this narrative over here.
It does feel like that, but it's more directly happening with One Nation, which is a growing but small political force, but is certainly seeing a poll bump at record levels in terms of public support. And it appears that the National and the Liberal parties are kind of panicking about that, and they're trying to work out whether or not they need to shift further to the right and really echo some of those policy positions to try and get that more right-wing voting base back into their camp.
And you mentioned there that Miles and Wong were in DC on that meeting. So what was the reason for them being there?
Well, they're having these talks that regularly occur with their counterparts, with Marco Rubio, with Pete Hegseth, and they're quite wide-ranging and they're behind the scenes. They give this coordinated public statement at the conclusion. All four of them went to the podium and they all said the same exact phrase, which is full steam ahead on AUKUS. Now, it's music to the Australian government's ears and to the opposition as well, because the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal is, you know, Australia's answer to security in the region. It relies on the US backing this deal. The Pentagon was conducting a review of the deal to decide whether it should go ahead. That review has been provided to the Australian government, and apparently, according to the public statements, it's full steam ahead. What we don't know, though, about AUKUS is we have no visibility on the detail of the review. We know that the US Navy Secretary, John Phelan, has said there are ambiguities. So we're in this situation where it does seem, from the optics and the very synchronized words in front of the microphone, that everything is going in a forward trajectory. But I'm also aware from the reporting of some of my colleagues at other networks in Australia, including the Nine newspapers, that once Donald Trump was with Anthony Albanese in the room, pressed on AUKUS, and he said, full steam ahead, that the Pentagon review, which had already been put together, had to be substantially rewritten to reflect his public sentiment.
Wow. It does actually chime with a lot of other issues around the US and the US government and administration, how it's running, that there's a real disconnect and a struggle to make sense of a lot of the pronouncements of Trump.
This is the confusion, because on the one hand, you know, when I was in that room, in the cabinet room with the Prime Minister and the President, and asked that question, President Trump, are you happy and confident that Australia is spending enough on defence? And he said they can only spend what they can spend. What a relief. The Australian government just let a sigh of relief out to say, okay, we've got the sign off from the US administration. They're no longer going to be pushing for us to increase to 3.5%. But behind the scenes, there is still that pressure. I don't think this is a conversation that is over. And we still don't know what happened in the room when the Australian and US sides actually sat down at the end of the year to kind of get to some kind of conclusion on this.
So getting back to Trump's latest insults on Europe, not Australia, it may well be a way of detracting from his woes at home. His administration, and more specifically this time, his Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, is coming under fire from both sides of the aisle over the strikes on drug boats or alleged drug boats. Hegseth supposedly told the commanding officer on the first strike, I think it was, to, quote, kill them all. After a couple of the people on the boat survived the initial strike, the second one killed them as well. Now that has been leaked, and the already legally dubious nature of the strikes have taken on a whole new illegality.
And once it was leaked, Pete Hegseth immediately throws the admiral in charge under the bus. Like, can you imagine the Australian Defence Minister, Richard Marles, going on TV first to say it was a good thing to do and then kind of point the finger? It really is incredible to see how this is unfolding in the US administration. But President Trump is backing Hegseth, and the pressure on him at the same time is certainly building. So it's a watch this space moment. I think many are surprised that Pete Hegseth has survived as long as he has. So there's obviously a reason that he has been maintained in the administration. Is this a moment where there's a rethink about his value and the risk that he poses in the long term?
Which is weighed up against his flag waving for the anti-woke agenda, which is clearly at the top of many in the administration's mind. So that may just become even stronger flag waving. You never know. Trump's insistence this is all about drug smuggling has also come under some strain after he pardoned the former president of Honduras, who was serving 40 years in a U.S. federal prison for smuggling 400 tons of cocaine into the country. There was no clear reason for the pardon beyond Trump saying it was a Biden stitch-up.
And it came at a pretty awkward time in the U.S.-Honduran relationship too, as Honduras is struggling to determine the winner in the presidential elections. Trump weighed in on one side, rather like he did in Argentina, threatening to withdraw aid if his favoured candidate lost. He is now marginally ahead, but the centre-right opponent is calling foul, Nick.
That's right. It's a real problem in Honduras. But there has been a win for Trump at home this week after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that gerrymandering by the Republican-led state of Texas to redraw political boundaries to favor their party was in fact okay. This could have huge ramifications as other states look to do the same thing to shore up Republican numbers in the midterm elections next year.
There is just such a lot going on in the U.S. nowadays that reverberates worldwide. It's hard to ignore. It's hard not to draw those parallels.
And we will continue to not ignore it. Yeah, that applies to the Ukraine as well. It's another story that is impossible to ignore. Trump is starting to pile pressure on Ukraine and Europe again to make more concessions to Russia.
And it was, you know, quite enormously surprising to me that the Ukrainian negotiators spent 3 days talking to the US team and got nowhere. At the same time, the US foreign policy strategy document was released, totally turning the notion of Russia being an enemy on its head.
It's quite amazing, actually. And I think it's caught a lot of the US politicians on the hop as well. Now being told Russia is not a threat and in fact offers huge business opportunities as an ally. Something the Kremlin was quick to agree with, unsurprisingly. They must be cock-a-hoop. What a dramatic change.
It must have politicians all over the world racing to figure out how this affects their long-term strategies in all kinds of ways, from relations with India, China, to engagement with Ukraine. I mean, Australia just upped its funding for Ukraine as part of the Coalition of the Willing, something that may be changing too. But it will also raise questions about intelligence sharing, of course. Trump's unorthodox approach to diplomacy has already caused a lot of raised eyebrows, with completely inexperienced friends of Trump taking on central roles in dealing with Russia, and in a way that has no oversight or security controls. It now just takes on an entirely new dimension.
Yeah, I think this is going to be something that's poured over for some time to come. And Trump's main guys that we just spoke of, Witkoff, and who is a property tycoon and mate of Trump, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, were on the road again talking to Putin and cutting deals with his main guy, another billionaire. But talks, by all accounts, mostly focused on business opportunities. Got to hand it to Putin. He's really playing a blinder. Now, Ukraine and Europe are playing catch-up, as we said, once again, to figure out how to keep Trump on side and support Ukraine so they don't allow Russia such a clear win by taking Ukrainian land they don't yet control. Putin came out and openly said this week that he would take the whole of the Donbass region, either with Ukraine's agreement or without. So no sign of compromise there, and a sentiment that Trump didn't push back against.
To the Syrian people, you have proven to the world that victory is just the beginning. So let's all continue the story of people who were patient and steadfast, turned victorious. Let's make victory a responsibility that makes us work seriously to rise in our country, to make it among the advanced nations.
That was Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara speaking there. Incredible as it may seem, it's been a year already since a rebel group in Syria toppled the decades-old Assad regime, sending Bashar al-Assad fleeing to the safety of Moscow. Since then, the former al-Qaeda leader Shara has been making all the right noises to get the international community to drop sanctions and help rebuild the country.
That's right. It's something he has been remarkably successful at, I think. Even getting a meeting at the White House with Donald Trump, and that seemed to go swimmingly. But not so successful at home, I don't think, where he's struggling to contain disputes with various minority groups. And many people are worse off now than they were under Assad. Joining us to take us through that is Bob Bowker, former Australian ambassador to Jordan, Egypt and Syria, and visiting fellow at the ANU Centre for Arab and Islamic Studies. Thank you for joining us, Bob.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to speak to you, Bob. Can you tell us, how would you rate Shara's first year?
I think we're seeing a classic case of a transition, or an attempted transition, between a revolutionary regime and an institutionalization of government. And it's particularly challenging for Shara, given his background and the baggage that comes with that, both as an Islamist and also because he is seeking to implant a form of government that reverses the historical situation, if you like, of the Sunni majority at the hands of the previous Alawite-dominated regime. And there's a distinct problem for Shara, as you mentioned, I think, in his dealings with the international community. He is making, I think, a very commendable effort, but he has yet to effectively reach out to his domestic audience. And it will take, I think, a great deal more effort and concrete achievement on his part before that level of respect and confidence develops, if it develops at all.
So he's struggling at home, essentially. What are his key challenges to overcome those hurdles?
Well, what we have initially, at least, is a situation where the sectarian tensions within Syria are playing out at the social level. The effects of losing such a substantial number of people going abroad, over 5 million, and now the efforts to for some of those people, about perhaps 1.8 million or so, to return to places which have been destroyed or in some cases been taken over by people from a different sectarian group. And that, of course, is causing tensions and difficulties. But in addition to that, there is a sense, I think, in places like Homs, that the government is not prepared to treat its citizens equally, that there is a tendency or a definite inclination to look more favourably upon those from the Sunni element who were active.
I should add here, Bob, if I can add, Homs, I think there's a large Alawite community in Homs, is that right?
There was. It was a mixed community, and it was one of the most heavily contested cities during the course of the civil war. But the Alawites have, I think, come under a great deal of pressure in the aftermath of that war, and there is a distinct sense of unease among the Alawites as to their future, in not only in Homs, but of course in the Alawite community more generally.
Can we talk about this new political department set up by the Foreign Office that has these worrying authoritarian overtones? Why is it so problematic?
Well, it's problematic because the evidence of institutional structure is at this stage pretty limited. There are elements within this new arrangement who are not answerable in any sense to an elected body. There are religious authorities implanted within the institutions who appear to have the capacity to overrule decisions or voices of regular civil servants. And there is an unrequited need for a sense of justice toward those who were guilty of crimes under the previous regime and who in the course of the past 12 months have been seen to be engaging in sectarian violence against Alawites, against Druze, and so on. So this, as I say, we're in a very fluid moment as far as the installation of a credible, predictable, judicially based system is concerned in Syria. And it has a long way to go, I think, before there'll be many Syrians feeling that they can understand what is going to be happening next.
The 2011 uprising essentially was about marginalized populations fighting for a voice and more recognition, etc. From what I hear, at least from those covering Syria on the ground, there's a much more ability for people to gather and to speak openly, and that's a big change. But how much does the old adage, it's the economy, stupid, applies here? So how much difference does Sharia need to make people's lives better?
Well, the first challenge for the government, I think, is to provide housing, to provide affordable food, education, health facilities and the like. If the government is not seen to be improving the lot of ordinary Syrians in that respect, then quite frankly, the capacity of the government to draw respect for what it is trying to do will be very limited indeed. But we have to remember that even if people are not satisfied with the government's performance, there is no serious suggestion that there should be a return to the days of the Assad regime. Those who fought the Assad regime were predominantly Sunni youth who had suffered at the hands of that regime. They were marginalized, as you said. They tended to be from the villages or the urban outskirts, and they were looking for a sense of satisfaction, if you like, vis-a-vis those who had maltreated them. But the values of those folk by no means attuned to the rhetoric that was popular among those who were the front, the faces, if you like, of the revolution in dealing with external audiences. You're talking still about a group of people whose values are deeply conservative, who are Islamist, who are not going to be particularly concerned about notions of democracy and empowerment of ordinary people. What they're looking for is clean government. What they're looking for is a sense that their kids are going to be able to be fed the day after tomorrow. And maybe beyond that, a sense that Syria will regain some of the standing that it once enjoyed in the international community. But those are values that Sharaa can deliver upon, given time and given the level of economic support that he is being promised by the Gulf Arab states and so on. The other problem, however, that Sharaa is facing is a drought. The situation of Syria in terms of water security has never been worse than it is at the moment. And that's true also across the region. You probably all know about the situation, the concerns about Iran, but there are concerns also about Iraq and Turkey. And there's nothing you can do really to sort out the impact of an absence of water on an agriculture-based economy, which is true of most of the Syrian economy in the northeastern part of the country.
Bob Bowker, thank you so much for your time and for giving us the benefit of your vast experience and knowledge of the region. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Cheerio.
Time to take a quick whip around the globe to touch on some of the issues, the other issues making headlines over the past 7 days. 200,000 people have fled their homes in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo in recent days as Rwanda-backed rebels advance on the strategic town of Uvira on the border with neighbouring Burundi. As we record this episode, I believe there are reports the town has in fact now fallen. The United Nations says at least 74 people had been killed, most of them civilians, and 83 admitted to hospital with wounds.
And this comes just days after Donald Trump hosted the Rwandan and Congolese leaders for the ceremonial signing of the pact affirming US and Qatari brokered commitments to end the war. In a joint statement, the US and 9 other members of the International Contact Group for the Great Lakes have voiced what they've called profound concern over the renewed violence. It said the new M23 rebel offensive has a destabilizing potential for the whole region, adding that the growing use of attack and suicide drones have marked a major escalation in the fighting and poses a serious threat.
Another war successfully ended by Trump, clearly. Eurovision has been plunged into one of its biggest rows in the song contest's near 70-year history after Israel was cleared by organisers to enter the 2026 competition. It triggered the immediate withdrawal of 4 countries this week in protest. Public broadcasters from Spain, the Netherlands, Slovenia, Ireland and Iceland all boycotting the event, citing the number of people killed in Gaza and accusing Israel of flouting rules meant to guard the contest's neutrality.
And Israel has released a statement. It says its critics are mounting a global smear campaign against them. As Australia's official broadcaster of the competition, SBS says its participation in and coverage of Eurovision will continue in 2026.
And Hong Kong's election saw a near record low turnout after the city's worst fire in nearly 80 years prompted anger against its China-backed authorities. But participation did edge higher than the previous vote held 4 years ago. Only candidates vetted as patriots by the government were allowed to run for the 90-seat legislature, with only 20 of those seats being directly elected, and the rest chosen by an election committee stacked with Beijing loyalists and special interest and professional groups.
Now, residents are continuing to voice their anger over last month's complex blaze that killed at least 159 people. It took nearly 2 days to extinguish, and authorities say substandard building materials used in renovating the high-rise housing estate were responsible for fueling that extremely tragic fire.
Thank you very much. This is truly one of the great honors of my life. Most importantly, I just want to thank everybody. The world is a safer place now.
Now, I don't claim to know much about football, but I do know that FIFA sits under a very big, dark cloud of corruption, and the power it wields, even over nation states, is huge. But they have excelled themselves, I would say, this week With the announcement of the World Cup draw, a moment of epic importance to billions, I believe, around the world. And, you know, footy fans rightly were tuning in. An opportunity not to be missed by Trump, it seems, who was given the ultimate gift by FIFA boss Gianni Infantino.
That's right, Nick. Trump has been very vocal and persistent about his desire for the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, now he has one of sorts. Not sure if it carries quite the same weight, though.
Well, the prize might be made up nonsense, but the way Trump was so unbelievably delighted to receive it, and he grabbed that medal and put it straight around his neck, you would be forgiven thinking that he believed it was of equal importance. There was no information given on the process of choosing the winner, though, of this newly minted prize, which Infantino said was beautiful. But the trophy, I thought, looked like something out of a horror movie, with all these hands reaching up to sort of drag the earth down into the abyss.
Emblematic.
It was quite terrifying, I would say. Trump also received it the same week his administration is under scrutiny over those lethal strikes that we talked about on alleged drug boats and his ramping up of threats against Venezuela. So, Anna, do you think it might become the next big thing for leaders around the world, the next big get?
I mean, it just encapsulates the extraordinary contradictions of the Trump administration, doesn't it? The fact that you can have the US president at the same time doing things that are both positive and negative, doing things that are both held up in lights and are appalling his allies, and that in the end, he's still looking to be feted and he still has people in the kind of international realm who want to give him that sense of his importance and who know that the way to his heart is through a medal.
Yeah. Or something of that ilk. Mm. Yeah, it doesn't matter how made up it is. As long as it's all about him, then he's happy, it seems.
Praise is the answer. And I think our own Prime Minister was very aware of that when he made his trip to Washington this year.
Yeah. No, he did a great
job. And he got the submarine. That's the present, the replica submarine. So the way to his heart, we know it's been tested. Trinkets.
Love it. Diplomacy at its finest. So that is the world this week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. New episodes will drop every Thursday. And hopefully, for your sake and everyone else's, it will be Claudia and Kat back next week.
Can't wait.
We'll see.
We have been missing them. Yeah. Very lucky to have you here at Parliament House for us to do this podcast this week in person together. It's been such an honour to be involved. What a year for this podcast. It's been great to have the chance to collaborate with you guys. And a big shout out to the producers who do such an incredible job behind the scenes, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dahlenberg.
Thanks, Anna. And thank you so much for joining me this week and making sense of the world, which is brilliant. And we'll see everyone again next week.
Thank you.